Well, good afternoon on this wonderful Friday, the 11th of July. Normally I come down here and the sun is shining, but today it is miserable as hell. My name is Simon Webster. I'm the Managing Director of Facts and Figures. We're independent financial advisors, and you're listening to Money Talk on Channel Radio. I'm here this afternoon with Paul Andrew, who's helping me push the buttons. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Simon. How are you?
Extraordinarily well, despite the weather. And your good self.
Despite being wet. Yeah,
yes, indeed.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I have to say, I have been admiring your rather fine jacket all morning. I'm
Thank you, sir. Jealous.
It's very nice. But apart from acting as my producer, possibly for the last time today, because apparently I'm allowed to fly solo now, Paul is also the presenter of the wildly successful Business Brunker, which goes out on Tuesday afternoons at, I forget, when is it, 1 o'clock?
1 till 2:30, yeah.
1 till 2:30. So he gets half an hour more than me, and he's been on every week, and he's got more listeners than me, so I'm very jealous. But it's a great show, and I recommend you listen in. Today we're going to be looking at inheritance tax, a very exciting subject for all of you, and salary diversion, which might come as news to one or two, but it's an exciting way of getting a lot more money in your pension, courtesy of the Chancellor. But before we do anything else, as it has now become traditional, we're going to have a look at the financial news in brief. And the top story this week is it's been alleged by the Treasury Select Committee that the government hard did British taxpayers to the tune of £1 billion in undervaluing Royal Mail when they made the sale. Taxpayers lost £1 billion. What do you think about that, Paul?
Well, you know, there's a number of things about that, really. I mean, I'm not a fan of governments and politicians, as you know, and I'm not actually much of a fan of Mr. or Dr. Cable either. But I have to say, it's really easy to be smart about valuations once they've been floated. And to be honest, the government employed, and I can't remember who did the float, but they employed a specialist to price and do the float. So blaming the government is not entirely accurate either. Whoever priced the issue is the people that price the issue.
Yeah.
It's sold.
They're supposed to be Chinese wolves because, of course, the other thing that was being knocked around this morning was the fact that the same people that priced the issue also bought some of the issue through one of their other divisions. And, of course, this is a practice endemic in the city, but it doesn't leave you with a totally comfortable feeling that it's been done properly.
But it's one of those things, though, Simon. You know, the trouble is people that don't understand how these things work are very quick to have a view on it, but without understanding the ins and outs of it. Quite often, a financial company like that is actually engaged on the basis that they can take up some of the issue in case the issue doesn't work.
Yeah.
So the idea is quite often that they get paid their fee on the grounds that they've priced it at a price, and if they don't sell enough, they will actually have to buy the remaining shares.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating issue. It's very wise to be very wise, very easy to be wise after the event. And the one that really gets me, of course, is how many times did they try and sell Royal Mail before they actually put it away this time? The Labour government had a go, and I think the Tory government prior to that had a go, and it had fallen at the first hurdle. Now we've actually got it into private ownership. It actually seems to be doing halfway well. The workers have got some shares. Post is coming in on time a bit more, and there does seem to be an ability for the company to compete going forward in a world market. So to me, I think it's been a huge success, but I can expect a few more rumblings coming along. Next story on the agenda, the Church of England cuts its ties with Wonga. The Archbishop Justin Welby, for whom I have a huge amount of time, was challenged about this on live radio several months ago now, that the Church of England had some slightly dubious investments and Wonga was perhaps one of them, charging fairly exorbitant interest rates to people who couldn't really afford them, and it has now finally cut its ties, because as Justin was keen to say, he cannot directly control where the pension fund invests its money. It's outside of his direct control. You had a few thoughts on this, didn't you, Paul?
Yeah, I did. I mean, again, it's one of those things that if you're not careful, if you start to dabble in politics, you get hung by your own petard. And the problem is that the Church of England pension fund, like most pension funds, doesn't directly invest in things. It invests in baskets of things. And it invests in a whole heap of things. So just diversifying their Wonga holding, my understanding is they actually had to divest a lot of other holdings they had, which has caused them to lose quite a significant amount of money. Now, you know, at the end of the day, they're politically hoist by that, and there's nothing they can do about it.
I don't even want to get into Wonga and the fact that it's a legal company doing legal things and all the rest of it, and I would never borrow money from them in a gazillion years. But some people do.
Well, you don't need to, Paul. You've got enough of your own.
But yeah, it doesn't, well, allegedly. Yeah.
Allegedly. Yeah. But it doesn't alter the fact that it's very interesting, this idea of ethical money and ethical finance. I think we're going to have to do a show on that subject because there's some very, very strong views on this. But we'll move on. The Bank of England is keeping interest rates at 0.5%. It's been going on for over 6 years. It barely merits a mention in the news anymore because it's been such a long-term thing. But Carney said, the governor of the Bank of England, "We expect that eventual increases in bank rate will be gradual and limited." He has also talked of rates hitting a new normal of around 2.5% by 2017, which makes the indebted like me feel very happy, but is not such good news for savers who have seen their returns over the last few years totally destroyed. Even if the Bank of England does start edging interest rates up before the end of 2014, we will still expect them to reach only 1.25% by the end of 2015, 2% by the end of 2016, and 3% by the end of 2017, said Howard Archer, who's apparently the chief UK and European economist at IHS Global Insight. I'm not sure I agree with him. I think he's a bit pessimistic. I think rates are going to stay a little bit lower than that for quite a long time. I think the idea that 2.5% is the new normal will probably gain some traction. He added there was considerable doubt as to whether the Bank of England's first rate increase would occur in late 2014 or early 2015. I think it's up for grabs. Where's your money going, Paul? What do you think?
Oh, I'm incredibly cynical about this. Incredibly cynical, because I'm on the other side of the fence here. I don't have a mortgage. I do have savings, and they're pointless because I get nothing in return for them.
You should give them to a good financial advisor to look after them. You're right. Okay. You get slightly better returns then.
Absolutely. I don't know any of that. Oh, yes, I do.
Thank goodness for that.
I've had a long-running battle on this because I think that they lack the political bottle to change interest rates. And the Bank of England target has been 2.5% base rate, and that target has been in place for something like 3 years. And they've been saying, we will get to 2.5% by 2015. We will get to 2.5% by 2015. And they have made no inroads into that at all. In fact, for a long period of time, they went the other way till we got down to 0.5% where we are at the moment. And I can't see anyone with the political will to let interest rates rise.
Having said that, is it really a political decision, though? I mean, the thing that really concerns me is that we are enjoying better recovery in the UK than much of the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And if we put interest rates up, then we run the severe risk of choking off that recovery because businesses need to borrow money to invest. And if their prices of borrowing go up, they can't borrow, they can't invest, and it kills jobs.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a real issue. So I'm not sure it's a political argument at all, Paul. But
I think it is, because I think there's a lot of dimensions to this. Because although interest rates are very low, actually lending isn't very good either. As a business, trying to borrow money from the banks, it's almost a forlorn hope. Unless you don't need the money, and then they'll lend it to you.
Yeah.
So there's a whole heap of dimensions to this. I would like to see interest rates at about 5%, but that's a personal thing because that would suit me. That's never going to happen in a million years now.
Well, I'm on the other side of the spectrum. I owe a lot of money, so it suits me that they're 0.5%, and all my borrowing is base rate linked, so long may it continue. I think we could spend a lot of time debating this. I think we seem to be talking about interest rates every week. Mm. But here's a little one that almost went past me. The highly regarded boss of Sainsbury's, Justin King, is to step down after 10 years as CEO of the group. He'd managed 9 years of consistent growth at Sainsbury's.
Right.
Now, when you think that that actually traverses a huge period of economic uncertainty, recession, the slump, and Sainsbury's has gone in chucking out decent results year on year for all that time, it just goes to prove that if you know what you're doing and you run your business properly, joining the recession was not compulsory, and he really made hay while the sun shines. I think this guy's going to write his own check for his next job.
Yeah, it's interesting though, isn't it? It'll be interesting to see how they perform post him, because if you look at Tesco's under Sir Terry Leahy, for instance, did very similar to that posted lots and lots of growth year after year after year. Terry Lee retired, not looking so good now. Even though he had a few dodgy moments, Rose at Marks and Spencer's managed to do some reasonable business. Boland, since he's taken over, not good. So if I was a Sainsbury's shareholder right now, I'd be looking at their succession planning with the eyes of a hawk, I think.
I don't blame you, but it goes to show that if you do know what you're doing in business, you can make money and you can move forward.
Absolutely.
Next story. Insurance companies are to be forced to provide clearer information on renewal quotes after coming under pressure from consumer groups. This is actually a far bigger story than I think has probably made the news, because the big issue is every single person, including you and I, have got insurance policies.
Absolutely.
And there's so many of these plans now are monthly renewable premiums, so the premium, the renewal comes along, and instead of getting a pack of paper that you would normally get and a chance to think about it, it just rolls over and somebody sends you a letter and we're all so busy you just tend to bin it, and you don't notice that your premiums have gone up by 20%, and you don't bother to shop around. And that's very bad news. When consumers are informed of a new premium, they're not usually reminded of what they paid previously. So as a result, some customers may not even be aware that the cost of their insurance policy is going up year on year, and it usually is. Now the new city regulator is drawing up rules to ensure that renewal quotes include previous premiums as well, so you can immediately see whether you're being asked to pay more than you paid the last year, and then you can make a decision as to whether or not it's a good idea to swap around. And I think that's a very good idea.
Absolutely.
Annual house price inflation is still edging up, and that's probably linked to the old interest rate story. According to the latest survey from the Halifax, prices may have fallen between May and June, but year on year prices are 8.8% up on this time last year. And as we regularly say on this show, the national average, which is what I've just quoted, masks huge differences between the various regions. So in London and the South East, where we're based, we're seeing price rises in excess of that. So it's really quite interesting. But the survey does provide some evidence that house prices house price growth is starting to moderate. So apparently, on the more reliable quarterly measure, prices in the 3 months to June were up 2.3% compared with the previous 3 months. So it does seem to be slowing down. The average house price across the UK is now £183,462, said the Halifax. You couldn't buy much round here for that, although you can get something, can't you?
You can, not a lot though.
No.
But that's the problem with looking at a market at that level, isn't it?
It is.
Basing it statistically, there are areas of the country where you could buy quite a substantial property for that, and there are areas of London where you'd be hard-pushed to acquire the lease on a dog kennel.
Yeah. Housing demand continues to be supported by an economic recovery that is gathering pace, with employment levels growing and rising consumer confidence, although real earnings growth remains sluggish, said Stephen Noakes, Halifax's mortgage director. So good for him. Here's one that really scared the living daylights out of me, Paul. I don't know how you feel about this. HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, now want access to our bank statements.
I saw that.
HM Revenue and Customs plans to ask banks for thousands of customers' personal bank statements under plans to seize tax directly from accounts. The Financial Times reports that statements will be handed out to HMRC so it can work out how much money it can take out of individuals' accounts without causing hardship. I think that's a huge step forwards, backwards, sideways. Very scary. Taxman actually being able to take money straight out of your bank. How would you feel about that, Paul?
I would not be happy at all. The HMRC, if anyone's listening from HMRC, you're lovely, really. HMRC are a pain to deal with at the best of times. They take money sometimes, in good faith. I'm not saying just mistakenly.
Yeah.
And trying to get it back is appalling. Whereas if you do the same to them, they go ape and go
penalties,
tonto,
fines, penalties, interest, fines. Yeah.
We could do with a bit of a level playing field, and that would actually help a lot more if HMRC played by the same rules as the rest of us are supposed to play
by. I actually had to phone HMRC yesterday. One of my kids has got to set up their own company, and we're just trying to get the corporation tax filed. And of course, I should employ an accountant, and any accountants listening, I'm really sorry, but the company only turned over a little bit, and we're just trying to do it on the cheap because my daughter doesn't want to run up any more bills. And I phoned up HMRC for a bit of information. I was number 17 in the queue, and I gave up being on hold after 15 minutes when I moved from 17 to 15. So please, lads, get a few more people on the phone because it's a real problem.
Absolutely.
Last on the news, I've got one here. Apparently, managers work an extra day per week in unpaid overtime. And this is a survey that's published results that are showing that UK managers, two-thirds of UK managers feel they're pressured to work extra hours from their employers, says the Institute of Leadership and Management. And it's really interesting when you think about this, because there's been a lot of discomfort and unhappiness in the public sector lately over paying conditions, with people in key jobs withholding labour. I think the technical expression is going on strike for better pay and to keep their final salary pensions. But in the private sector, for some time, there's been a huge amount of pressure on middle management, and people are really starting to feel it.
Absolutely.
And it says here, when you add up all the skipped lunch breaks, the early morning conference calls and after-hours emails, you can see just how widespread the extra-hours culture is within UK business, says ILM Chief Executive Charles Elwin. Of course, all organisations face busy periods when employees will feel motivated to work above and beyond their contractual hours, but excessive hours are not sustainable. I tend to agree with that. There are only so many times you can burn the midnight oil before your performance, decision-making and well-being begin to suffer. And I think that's true. I speak to a lot of people who are actually really trying to screw the extra half hour out of their staff here or there. We try and send all ours home at 5:30 on the nose to make sure that they actually get a decent night's R&R at home and come back reasonably refreshed and motivated to work really hard the next day. So if you're listening, staff, we love you. Thank you so much for all you're doing. But please work a bit harder. And I don't take any sugar in my coffee these days. So that's the news. And I think from that, I'm going to move on. And we want to move on, and I don't push the button, which means that it doesn't do what it's supposed to.
UK. Temp Network have hundreds of vacancies across West Kent. We offer ongoing work, weekly pay, and a variety of shift patterns to suit your needs. Visit us at www.tempnetwork.co.uk or call Tunbridge Wells 531 777.
Now let's work it to the bone, bone, bone. Come on, work.
I'm really excited to play this one. The weather was so miserable, I needed something to cheer me up, and the guitar riff on this just blows me away.
I see me on life.
And the scary thing is, we were just talking about the fact that Chrissy Hynde is now pushing 70. How old does that make us feel, Paul?
It's a horrible thought, isn't it?
It is a horrible thought. But she's still touring, still making fantastic music, and that, to me, remains one of the great guitar riffs of all time. So now we move from music to inheritance tax. And really, as we're getting on, we've got to start thinking about these things, because sadly, inheritance tax is something that's usually paid, but not always, on death. Absolutely. So we always find the interesting things to talk about that are motivational and exciting to get on this show. But it's a sad fact that inheritance tax is something that is paid on death. And in fact, it used to be called death duty. Mm. And at one stage, it was called capital transfer tax. But IHT, as it is now, was first introduced in 1986. I vaguely remember it coming in. Mm. At the time, Roy Jenkins, later Lord Jenkins of Hillhead, described inheritance tax as a voluntary levy paid by those who distrust their heirs more than they dislike the Inland Revenue. I thought that was rather clever. A voluntary levy paid by those who distrust their heirs more than they dislike the Inland Revenue. Sadly, since then, the Tolly's tax guide on this subject has now got up to 958 pages of mostly gobbledygook. It's up 63% from 2001-2. So it would effectively take even the world's fastest speaker, which is not me, 10 hours to read non-stop. It is a bureaucratic nightmare. And it really is starting to make a big bite. The Inland Revenue have been raising about $3 billion a year in inheritance tax for the last few years. I understand it last year, 14,629 people, not 628, 14,629 people, or 2.6% of the total who die every year, paid inheritance tax. And even after all the legal sheltering's taken place, the average tax-paying estate was worth £875,000. And according to HMRC, that was made up of about 190 grand's worth of cash, £253,000 worth of shares or investment bonds, and £329,000 worth of residential property. But the interesting thing is, due to regional house price disparity, most of those taxpayers live in London and the South East, or certainly London and the Home Counties, because property prices down here, the average in the nation, we were saying earlier, one might be £185,000, but in reality, I suspect the average in the South East is nearer of £250,000, and that means there are an awful lot of houses worth an awful lot more than that. So what is inheritance tax? Well, basically speaking, if you die and your personal assets are worth in excess of £325,000, you pay tax on that excess at 40%. If you are married, if you're married, then you and your spouse have a combined £650,000 between you, and you can pass your allowance between spouses. So if you are a married couple and you're worth less than £650,000 dead, inheritance tax isn't really going to be an issue for you, but it is still going to bite for an awful lot more people than I think probably realise it. Because the truth of the matter is, at one stage, the threshold, the nil rate band as it's called, was going up fairly quickly. But in fact, it's been pegged at 325 for the last couple of years and will be pegged next year as well. And it will be very interesting to see by how much it goes up when the brakes are off next year, because the Tories were talking about having £1 million threshold for husband and wives, but I don't think the Liberal Democrats were so keen on that, so they settled on 650 between the two. And Labour government is certainly very keen to find other ways of raising revenue, and of course they think that rich people are fair game, and the net result of that is that we're probably not going to see the threshold rise very quickly. Meanwhile, the property inflation is running at 8% a year. We were just talking about that. And so you can soon see a situation where people whose estates are under the threshold now, in 10, 20, 30 years' time when they eventually die, could well be caught up in the inheritance tax net. And if people don't start making plans for it early, there could be a fairly significant amount of tax to pay. Bear in mind, it's $3 billion a year that George Osborne is taking from people's pockets at the moment, and that's a huge issue. And there's an interesting debate on the rights and wrongs of inheritance tax, because two classes of assets are largely exempt. One is farmland and the other is business assets. So if you happen to own a business, you can sometimes get away with something called business property relief, which keeps it outside your estate, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But the other one that's largely exempt is farmland, and one of the things that that exemption is doing is it means a lot of rich people are using their money to buy farms. And that's pushing up the price of farmland. If farmland is expensive, what do you think that's doing to the price of food? Exactly that. And so there's consequences in all these things. People say, well, soak the rich, make them spend more money. And effectively, you end up in a situation where doing that pushes up the price of your weekly food bill. So there are consequences. So inheritance tax is there. 40% if you're over, if you've got assets over £650,000, if you're a married couple, what can you do about paying it? And there are some things that you can do. I mean, the first thing you can do is give stuff away and not have more than £650,000 worth of stuff when you die. But to avoid that sort of deathbed giveaway, they now say you have to live 7 years before your gifts are deemed to be fully outside your estate. So the first thing to do is give stuff away and survive 7 years. If you don't make it the first 7 years, then there is a taper relief that effectively means if you survived 3 to 4 years, then 20% is outside of your estate. You survive 4 or 5 years, 40%, 5 or 6 years, 60%, and under 6 and under 7, 80% of your gift is outside the estate. But nonetheless, you've got to survive that 7 years when you give stuff away. So that's the first thing. The second thing you can do, and it's not very sexy, but it's a blooming sight cheaper than paying the tax, is buying some life insurance. Now, as I started out in my career selling life insurance for a living, I have a soft spot for this particular ruse, because, of course, if you buy life insurance and put the life insurance policy proceeds in trust, an expression you'll hear me come back to on a few occasions later on, it's not very hard to do with a life insurance policy. You put the proceeds in trust, then those proceeds are outside your estate for inheritance tax purposes. So if you have £1 million estate, you've got a tax bill on £350,000, 4% of £350,000 is about £130,000, quick mental maths. So you buy a £130,000 life insurance policy, and when you die, that policy pays out and pays the tax. Now, you could say, well, I don't want to be shelling out premiums on a monthly basis to pay for a life insurance policy. But given the choice between paying a life insurance premium each month at a very modest rate or writing a check for £130,000 when you die, which one are you going to go for, Paul?
Well, here's the thing, Simon. I'm not going to go for it because it doesn't affect me. But what I would recommend is my heirs actually think very heavily about taking out a life insurance policy on me.
I think that's a very good idea, and in fact, that's not unusual at all. Mm. Quite often, the heirs pay the premium to make sure that they get the full benefit of an estate that's passed down to them. Yeah. And it's very interesting, this, because in our house, because I work with money for a living, from a very young age, my kids have been fairly well aware of our financial situation, when it's been good and when it's been not so good. And there have been plenty of times when it's been not so good. And what that's meant is, when we've got the supermarket checkout and we've been balancing the pennies, they haven't been pestering for extra things because they knew we were broke at the time.
Right.
Sadly, it also means that they know when we're in funds, and they sort of do tend to, well, actually, they're very good, to be fair. But in a lot of families, talking about money is actually a hugely embarrassing and difficult thing, and kids are very, very nervous about bringing this up. And a lot of older people don't actually realize the consequences of not actually dealing with their affairs in good time, well before they die. And it just seems such a shame that people are sort of drifting through ignorance and through life in ignorance, so they get to the stage where it's really too late to do anything about it, and there's a large tax bill paid quite unnecessarily when some proper planning could have done something about it.
It's interesting, just to interject there, sorry Simon, but it's interesting as well with the demographic that's happening at the moment, where more and more couples are getting divorced as well.
Yeah.
So, kids actually have two parents to worry about separately and two lots of inheritance tax to think about.
That's right. And I mean, if you are on your own, it's then only £325,000 is the limit for an individual. So if you're not married, £325,000 is it. So if you've got a house and a bit of life insurance and a bit of a pension fund and some stuff, the technical term for which is personal chattels, a marvellous old English expression, and your stuff altogether is worth over £325,000. Say it's only worth £500,000. only £500,000. £150,000 of your estate is then taxable, and that's a nearly £40,000 tax bill that your heirs are going to have to pay before they can touch your stuff. Because the interesting thing, and it's not commonly known, is that the executors of your estate have to pay the tax before they can distribute your stuff. The Chancellor wants his money before your kids get it.
Right.
Which is actually quite a salutary thing. So it's very good news, because if you're a businessman and you've got some good investments and you've got some not so good investments, what are you going to want to give the Chancellor? You probably want to give him his not so good investments, and a life insurance policy is often regarded as a not very good investment. So give the Chancellor the proceeds of your life insurance policy and give your good stuff to your family. And I think there's a lot of sense in that argument. I think a lot of people have differing attitudes to inheritance tax. Some people say, I've worked hard all my life, and if my kids get anything when I die, they should count themselves blooming lucky. And there's a fair few wealthy people actually starting to talk about distributing their significant wealth to charities and other good causes, and just giving their kids maybe a small house as something to get them started. And who wouldn't mind having a small house? But when your parents are actually giving away millions or billions, it might make you weep a little bit. Mm. But a lot of people in the sort of middle ranks with maybe £1 million to distribute are thinking, well, I've worked hard all my life, I got nothing when I started. If my kids get anything at all, they're lucky, so I can't be bothered to do anything about it. And that's when perhaps the children buying the life insurance policy makes a lot of sense, because it's a very cheap way of paying the tax that otherwise they will have to pay in one big lump sum. Another possible attitude is, I've worked hard all my life, and I don't care who gets my money as long as it is not the Chancellor of the Exchequer. I've paid too much blooming tax all my life. I don't want to be paying any more. And of course, that means that you've got to do some planning, because otherwise the Chancellor is the one who's going to get your dosh. So you really need to think about it in that sort of situation. And there are some people who say, just don't talk to me about it. I don't care. I'm not interested. I don't want to think about it. But for those of you who are actually interested in preserving your estates, here's a few things that you need to think about. The first thing you need to think about is making a will. Now, we'll have a session on wills and intestacy and probate and all that good stuff in a later show. But effectively, a will is a document that says, if I die, so-and-so, I want so-and-so to get my stuff. If you do not make a will, then there is a law that says who gets your stuff. And I'm not going to go through it now, but it's fairly complicated, and the results are not necessarily what you would expect. There are circumstances where a wife can end up paying rent to her children for the privilege of living in the marital home. I'm not joking when I say that. It's absolutely not unusual for that to happen, where people die intestate without making a will. So stage one of any form of planning is make a will. And it makes you think about who you want to get your stuff when you die. Again, a little bit morbid, but the nice thing is you spend a wet Friday afternoon doing the job, then you put it in a drawer somewhere, preferably lodge it with a solicitor or in a bank safety deposit box or whatever, just put it somewhere safe, and then you've actually thought through who will get your stuff when you die. The next thing to think about is, what are you actually worth? You may not feel terribly rich. Let's say your house is worth £300,000. But if you're lucky enough to be earning halfway decent money, you might have some life insurance on your mortgage. You might have some life insurance with your death in service benefit at work. And by the time all that money's come into your estate, all of a sudden, you've got an inheritance tax liability there. And this is particularly of interest, or gets particularly serious, if you're not married to your partner. Because again, it's the old £325,000 rule. So making a will is particularly important for those who are not married, because unmarried partners do very badly in intestacy cases. They do very badly indeed. And they are in the same sort of problem if there's an inheritance tax bill to pay, because they don't get the benefit of the spousal exemption. So there's a couple of reasons there where you really need to give serious thought to making a will, making a plan, making sure you know what's going on. So we've talked about life insurance, we've talked about making a will. What else can you do to avoid inheritance tax? Well, I think we're going to have another song while I gather my thoughts.
Jobsinkent.com.
the sun in his jealous sky as we walk in fields of gold. So she took her love for to gaze a while upon the fields of barley. In his arms she fell as a head came down among the fields of gold. Will you stay with me? Will you be my love among the fields of barley? We'll forget the sun in his jealous sky as we lie in fields of gold. See the west wind move like a lover's soul upon the fields of barley. Feel her body rise when you kiss her mouth. Promises likely, and there have been some that I've broken, but I swear in the days still left, we walk in fields of gold. We walk in fields of gold. Summer days among the fields of barley. See the children run as the sun goes down among the fields of barley. You'll remember me when the west wind moves upon the fields of barley. You can tell the sun in his jealous sky. We walked in fields of gold. Yeah, we walked in fields of gold. Yeah, we walked in fields of gold.
Oh, you just want to fall asleep listening to that. It's such a beautiful song. Such a beautiful song. I'm a great fan of Sting. I went to see the Police at Twickenham about 2 years ago.
Right.
Absolutely blew me away. Got nothing to do with inheritance tax, so we're back on track. We've talked about the fact that it's quite expensive. We've talked about the fact that you've got to make a will. One of the things we haven't talked about is residential property ownership. Over the years, people have tried to find all sorts of ways of getting the main residence out of the grasp of the Chancellor. And the most popular thing was some form of lease carve-out arrangement whereby you carried on living in your own house but sold yourself a lease. And the net result of that was it was supposed to devalue the house. The Inland Revenue hate that. They've challenged it and they've won. And generally speaking, I have yet to see, I'll probably get a few phone calls about this afterwards, and if I do, I will let you know, but I've yet to see anything that gets the residential house out of the inheritance tax net if you want to carry on living in it. It's deemed to be a gift with reservation, which means you reserve title back to yourself, and the revenue hate it, and arguably, from the point of view of the tax, quite rightly. So I've yet to see anything. So if anybody knows of a good way of getting the residential house out of the inheritance tax net, then let me know. But really, you're talking about inheritance tax planning with your money, and it's a question of how you use various types of investment that are available. And there are two strands of investment. Both involve using trusts. And I promised you a bit earlier I'd explain what a trust is, and I'm going to start with that. And so that's a trust, T-R-U-S-T, as opposed to a truss, which is what Paul Andrews wears. Exactly. But a trust is effectively a legal person. It's a bit like a company. A company is owned by shareholders and run by directors. A trust is not really owned by anybody. It's set up by a settlor, the person with the stuff to start with. It's run by trust. trustees, and they are governed by the trust deed, which is just a book of words that says the trustees can do this with the money. And the ultimate beneficiary, the people who get the money at the end of the day, are the people whose interests the trust are generally run for. But you can also have something called a life tenant, which is somebody who gets a benefit from the trust during their lifetime or for a period of time until the stuff ends up in the hands of the beneficiaries. So you could take an example where you've got a typical family, mum, dad, two kids, and dad sets up a trust to benefit his wife during her lifetime, and then the kids get the stuff at the end. And normally you would put cash in there. Let's say you put £100,000 in the trust, and then the husband dies. The wife would get the interest from that £100,000 during her lifetime, and then each kid would get 50,000 quid at the end of the day. Now, there's whole sections of legislation about balancing the interests of the life tenant with the beneficiaries, and you'll be very pleased to know that today we are not going to go there. I think we might get a lawyer in to talk about that one, because there's actually a very famous case on that one, NatWest versus Nestle, which we'll come back to another day. Suffice it to say, however, trusts are probably a lot more simple than a lot of people realise, and they are the bedrock of inheritance tax planning. The nice thing about a trust is that because it is a separate legal person, then the stuff, and I keep saying the stuff because it's an easiest way of encumbering property or cash or other assets, the stuff can be moved from the ownership of the settlor, the person who has the stuff in the first place, into a trust, and then other people can get the benefit of it at a point in time. One of the most popular, well, popular common forms of trust is a will trust. It only comes into being on the death of the settlor. And then on the death of the settlor, stuff goes into trust, typically for the benefit of the wife, and ultimately for the wife during her lifetime, and then ultimately for the benefit of the kids. And that's a fairly popular trust setup. But you can also set up trust during your lifetime to do some inheritance tax mitigation. There are two sorts that are mainly used these days. One is called a gift trust, and the other is called a discounted gift trust. With a gift trust, it's typically set up with a loan whereby the settlor, who has, let's say, £100,000, lends the trust £100,000. Now, that's very useful for somebody who actually might want his capital back, because the big problem with a lot of inheritance tax planning is you have to give your stuff away. And if you give your stuff away, then you're always worried that you might run out of money. If you need long-term care, you've got no money. And that's a real issue. If you only loan the money out of your estate, then effectively you've got access to being able to take that money back whenever you need to. And that can be hugely advantageous. But the reason you might put that money into trust is that all the growth on that money is immediately outside your estate. So if you put £100,000 in a trust and it stays in that trust for a couple of years, well, say it's more than a couple of years, say it stays in there for 10 years, that money might conceivably double in value if it's been well invested. Now, if that money doubles in value over that period of time, you've got £100,000 of growth outside of your estate that would otherwise have suffered a £40,000 tax bill. So there is a very good reason for thinking about gift and loan as a way of getting money outside your estate fairly quickly, and it immediately puts that growth outside of the estate. Very important to get decent advice on this, because it's not that straightforward to set up, but it is actually relatively straightforward for a halfway decent financial advisor, and Paul and I have been looking around to find one, to actually make that happen for you. So that's one thing to bear in mind. The other thing you can do is something called a discounted gift trust. Now, the nice thing about a discounted gift trust is it's recognised by the Inland Revenue as being a perfectly legitimate way of getting money outside of your estate, because you would set it up in such a way as you get income back from that money, and the Inland Revenue still gets a piece of the action. So they effectively allow a discount on that gift, so you've got money out of your estate day one. Again, without going through charts and explaining the numbers in detail, you can end up confusing people listening on the radio. So I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail, but just be aware the situation exists. And it's very good for those people who maybe don't want the capital, but they do want income from that money. So it's well worth bearing in mind. Say we've talked about a gift and loan, and we've talked about a gift trust. And then the real issue with these things, though, is that in order for the gift to be fully outside your estate, you've got to survive 7 years. So if you've got this 7-year clock to get stuff outside your estate and you suddenly discover you've only got 3 years to live, which is perhaps a little bit what's the word, morbid to consider, it doesn't alter the fact that there are still things that you can do, because the other big relief for inheritance tax is something called business property relief. Now, that's usually set up for people to go out and buy shares in the AIM market, which is generally regarded by everybody, including me, as being relatively high risk because it's small companies. It's in the alternative investment market, and it's an alternative investment because it's relatively high risk. So if you were buying shares in the AIM market, you would be taking quite a risk with your capital. And a lot of people say, well, I'm worried about paying the tax, but the last thing I want to do is start frittering it away, making dodgy investments in companies that might go splat. But what you can do is there are products that are structured to take advantage of the AIM exemption, the business property relief exemption, that don't quite involve the same degree of risk, but they get the same 2-year clock. So you could take your £100,000 and put it into a business property relief qualifying investment, and that way you would find that you had got yourself your £100,000 outside of your estate in only 2 years, and that's well worth doing. One last thing. There are people around who are fortunate enough to own their own businesses. They make a fair few bob doing it, and all the time they own the shares in that company, they are outside the estate for inheritance tax purposes because they qualify for business property relief. Let's think about Granddad, who set up the family business. He owns a company. Let's pretend it's worth £1 million. It could only be worth a few bob, but let's pretend it's £1 million. That £1 million is outside of the estate for inheritance tax purposes, right up until the time he sells the shares to his kids, at which point they no longer qualify for business property relief. Let's pretend he sells them to a third party altogether, and he just banks £1 million. That £1 million cash has just walked straight into his estate, and what he's just done is taken something that had no tax liability and given himself a £400,000 tax liability. So if you have your own company and you are thinking of selling out your shares one way or the other, it's very important that you take very careful advice about what happens to your inheritance tax position when you get rid of your company assets, because if you don't take real care, you could end up with a serious tax bill that you weren't expecting. And it's surprising how many lawyers and accountants miss this. They focus on the sale, they focus on getting you the best value, they focus on the entrepreneur's relief you get from selling your shares, which you don't pay a whole pile of tax, but you end up with a big inheritance tax bill.
Okay. Can I ask a question now?
You can ask. I don't know if I know the answer, but you can try.
If the business owner dies,
yeah,
and has left the will leaving the shares to offspring, it what happens under those circumstances?
Well, the good news is the business property relief kicks in, and if he's owned the shares for 2 years, it's ignored as part of the inheritance tax ticker. Right, so okay. It's actually worth hanging on to the shares, right, and then passing to the children, yeah, on death, which you can do through a will. But if you actually sell out before then because you want the cash, that's when you create yourself the problem. Right. So it's worth being aware of that. I had a whole pile of stuff to talk to about trusts during this show, but in truth of the fact, time has marched on. So what I'm going to say is this. If you are interested in inheritance tax planning, if you think that you might have an inheritance tax liability or your parents might have an inheritance tax liability, we've got a couple of guides at Facts and Figures on inheritance tax. So can I invite you to tweet the show, which is moneytalk_guru, and give us your email address, and I will personally send you, with our compliments, a free of charge guide on some of the things you can do to mitigate inheritance tax. So if you tweet the show, and if you're not moneytalk_guru, or you can email ifa@fffp.co.uk. That's ifa@fffp.co.uk. We'll send you a complimentary guide put out by one of the insurance companies, is not even ours, that gives you a really good idea of some of the things that you can do about inheritance tax. And then when you want us to explain it to you in English and help you make some plans, we'll be very happy to sort it out. But it's quite often it's a difficult subject to bring up. So you might say to a parent, I heard this on the radio the other day, Mum, Dad, it might be worth having a chat about. Do you want to get that nice Simon to come out and explain it to you? Because it might be worth looking at, because you could save a few bob. And we're very happy to do that. We'll come out at our expense and just walk through the pros and cons of inheritance tax planning with parents, because it really is worth doing, because it will take a huge bite out of your estate if you don't do something about it. Wow. Big session. And now for something completely different. Now we're going to talk about something that every employer and every employee ought to be thinking about very seriously, particularly in the run-up to auto-enrollment, or in fact, as auto-enrollment has already bitten for a number of employees in larger companies. But it's certainly something that anybody who's involved in an employer-sponsored pension arrangement ought to know about and be thinking very seriously about using. And that's salary exchange, sometimes referred to as salary diversion, or sometimes referred to as salary sacrifice. And it is a perfectly legitimate, authorised, allowed, totally reputable way of saving national insurance and getting that money paid into your pension if you and your employer can come to a decent deal. Let me give you an example. If you earn $30,000 a year and you put 5% of your salary, that's £1,500 a year, into pension, you'll get income tax relief on that, which is great and worth having, and you'll take home $22,000 a year after tax, national insurance, and paying your pension contribution. But that's all that goes into your pension. Your £1,500 with the tax relief and the employer's contribution. But if you take a pay cut, which sounds really Irish, if you take a pay cut, you pay less tax and less national insurance. And interestingly, so too does your employer. And the net result of paying less tax and national insurance is you save money. And that saving can be used to go into your pension. Now, this would be really helpful if we weren't on radio and I could show you a table and show you the pretty numbers. I'm going to throw some numbers at you. If you get lost, I'm really sorry. But all you've got to do is tweak the show, moneytalk_guru or ifa@fffp.co.uk by the email. And I will gladly send you a worked example based on your salary. So just email or tweet with your salary on. Probably best to email only with your salary on, because tweet everybody else will know. And we'll show you how much money you could save if you went down the salary diversion route. But if we take our £30,000 example, somebody on £30,000 a year would pay £4,000 in income tax, where they would pay £2,645 in national insurance, and the net cost after basic rate tax relief of their £1,500 pension contribution would be £1,200. That means that person would take home £22,154.72. And the pence are very important, because Paul and I are great believers in the pennies. From the employer's point of view, the employer is going to pay that £30,000 salary. They're also going to pay £3,042 in national insurance, because it's give or take 10%. It's actually about 12.5%. I can never remember what the exact number is, but it's not on all the money. But in these terms, it works out damn near 10% of the total package. And then the employer's going to make a pension contribution of £1,500 as well, because we've pretended in this example that both the employer and the employee are putting 5% of that salary into pension each. The net result of that is that the cost to the employer is £34,542. So you might have a headline salary of £30,000, but you've cost the employer £35,000. And at the end of the day, your £1,200 plus £300 tax relief and the employer's £1,500 has got £3,000 into your pension. If you do it on salary diversion, it actually puts the pension contribution up by £508. And this is, and it's cost you absolutely nothing, and it's cost the employer absolutely nothing. So it's an extra £500, an extra sixth in your pension scheme for nothing. If somebody could give you an extra sixth of your money in your pension, would you go for it, Paul?
I would indeed.
I think you'd be very wise. Let's work through the numbers. So when we started out, you'd be on £30,000. We're going to suggest that you take a pay cut on paper to £28,235.30. In case you're thinking I'm particularly smart, I've actually got a computer program that works it out for me. So you've taken a pay cut to £28,235. Because you're now earning less money, instead of the £4,000 worth of tax you were paying, you're now paying £3,600, because on paper, you're earning less money, so you pay less tax. It also works with the national insurance. You were paying £2,645. On the lower salary, you'll now pay £2,433, a saving of £200 to you in national insurance. At that point, you'll take home pay with a lower salary, but less tax and less national insurance, and now you're not paying your pension contribution either. Your take-home pay is still £22,154.72. It's incredible what you can do with a computer. It works out the numbers, so your take-home pay is totally unchanged. But what we want to also do is make sure that the cost to the employer is also totally unchanged. So the company was paying out a salary of £30,000. It's now paying out a salary of £28,235.30, exactly the same as we said earlier. But the company is now also paying £2,798 in National Insurance. It was paying £3,042. So you as employee and the company as employer have both saved a huge amount in National Insurance. The net result of that is that the cost of the company was £34,542. To bring in the cost at exactly the same, the company can now afford to pay that £3,508 into pension. So this is where just straightforward manipulation of the numbers has worked in your favour, and you've ended up in a situation where an extra £500, an extra third of the value of your pension contribution, has been paid into the pension just by manipulation of the national insurance system. And just so, there's a lot of talk lately about dodgy tax breaks and doing things that you shouldn't do, and a lot of celebrities are being had up for dodgy practices in their tax affairs. This one is totally and utterly 100% legitimate. You can go onto the HMRC website and look up salary diversion or salary sacrifice, they tend to call it, and you will see that it's there. And the whole point of it is that salary, bonus, overtime, various other allowances, they're all taxable and they're all assessable to National Insurance. But the great thing is that the pension contributions are not assessable to tax. So if the company makes a pension contribution on your behalf, there is no tax on it, there's no P11D benefit on it, there's no national insurance to pay on it. So the more the company pays in a pension contribution for you, as a percentage, it costs them less than paying salary, because everything else they have to pay you is nickable. Everything else they pay you, you pay tax on. So a pension contribution is a very good way of getting money out of a business and making sure that you get the absolute best value for it. Here's a thought. If you're a company director or senior manager and you're making a personal pension contribution yourself from your own bank account, ask yourself why you're doing it. Because in the vast majority of cases, it will be more tax efficient to actually get the company to make that contribution on your behalf. The company gets the tax relief on it. It doesn't cost the company anything extra to do it, but it keeps that money from going through your personal bank account. And that has got to be the way to deal with it. So We've talked about inheritance tax this week. We've had a good look at that, and we've talked about salary diversion. If you'd like more information on these subjects, then all you've got to do is tweet moneytalk_guru or email ifa@fffp.co.uk, and you will find a guide on this subject coming through to you post haste. We're really keen to give you this information. We're really keen to save you some money, and we reckon that inheritance tax planning and salary diversion will be two ways you can put more money in your bank account in the most tax efficient way you can possibly go for it. So Simon and Paul say goodbye to you. Thank you for listening, and we'll listen to you next time when I can't remember what I'm talking about, but I'm sure it's going to be good.
Goodbye for now.
Cool.